The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable James A. Kinect presiding.
This is our case number 421-0391, People of the State of Illinois versus James Curtis. Would counsel for appellant please state your name for the record?
Good afternoon. My name is Roxana Mason. I'm from the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I represent Mr. Curtis.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
Douglas Malcolm for the state.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court. This case involves two issues, ineffective assistance of counsel and a violation of the statutory right to confrontation. Time permitting, I would like to address both of these issues in this order, but before I do that, I'd like to briefly touch on a problem that underlies both of these issues. Evidence that was critical to Mr. Curtis's defense at his violation hearing was destroyed before that hearing could occur. And that is not Mr. Curtis's fault. Mr. Curtis did everything he could have in this case. When his accuser visited him in the jail, she told him two things. One, she told him that the reason she had made these allegations was that she believed that he was having an affair with another woman. And number two, she told him, threatened him, that if she learned that he had impregnated that other woman, she would ensure that he remained in custody.
Counsel, excuse me. I have a question regarding something you just said, and that is the nature of this evidence. You indicated that you described it as critical, but is it exculpatory evidence or is it potentially useful evidence?
It is exculpatory in nature. It both corroborates Mr. Curtis's version of events and it impeaches his accuser's version of events. It shows that she did not make these allegations by her own words. She did not make these allegations because they are true, but instead that she made these allegations because she believed that Mr. Curtis, her significant other at the time, was engaged in extracurricular activities with another woman. So it's exonerating in that sense. It may not be wholly and completely exonerating, but it is certainly of an exonerating nature. Particularly given the evidence in this case, it really was just Mr. Curtis's word against that of his accuser. There, was no videotape of what happened in the home. There was, the physical evidence sort of equally corroborated both versions of the event, except for the accuser's claim that Mr. Curtis had wielded a table at her. There were photographs taken of that table, and the table is quite large, wood appears to be quite heavy from the photographs that the police took. So that undermines the credibility and plausibility of her version of events to some extent.
How about her injuries?
Her injuries, she did have some minor injuries. Mr. Curtis did admit in his own version of events that some of the injuries to her arms were from when he was defending himself against her when she came after him with a hammer. In terms of the other injuries, they could have corroborated her version of events, but equally corroborated Mr. Curtis's testimony that she had gotten into a fight with a woman shortly before, a few days before the events that resulted in the police being called that day.
What do we do with the fact that your client admitted by his plea to strangling this person?
I mean, that's certainly a fact. He did plead guilty in that case.
But he did not only plead guilty, he pled guilty to strangling.
Yes.
Which, if I'm remembering correctly, is as an aggravating factor or a factor that's taken into account in how it's charged, how the offense is charged. Am I correct?
I mean, yes, that's absolutely true that were the issue presented one, regarding those charges that underlie the guilty plea. Yes, he absolutely confessed to that when he pled guilty. And that was actually an issue that was litigated to some extent, whether that information could be used as evidence of a propensity to commit other crimes. Sure. And the trial court below ultimately ruled that, you know, it would not consider that as propensity evidence in this unique circumstance, that the statute that allows for propensity evidence simply doesn't cover these sorts of violation hearings. So I don't think it really weighs in, it should weigh into this court's determination, you know, for those reasons. You know, additionally, there's evidence here that this was something that, you know, it was a very volatile relationship, and the judge who had to make the determination of whether Mr. Curtis violated his probation had to decide who to believe, Mr. Curtis or his accuser. And that's exactly what this tape would have helped the judge do. And I think it's really important to remember that this isn't something that Mr. Curtis came up with, you know, after he was found to have violated his probation at the last moment, you know, as sort of a last-ditch effort. It's something that he contacted his attorney immediately after the visit with his accuser. He's the one who reached out and tried to get his attorney to do something, and then it was just his attorney dropping the ball and doing nothing for 25 days that ultimately led to this video being destroyed. And that brings me to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that we have here. You know, Steitel, Bryant, Tate, Upshaw, all the cases that are cited in the briefs, talk about how failure to obtain and present this exculpatory evidence is objectively unreasonable. And that's what this evidence would have been here in this case. And counsel failed to do anything to obtain it. Now, the state argues—
Is it clear from the record that your client told counsel what would show up on the video that he wanted him to try to obtain?
It's clear from the record that he told him that it would be a conversation that was recorded between him and the accuser. In the offer of the counsel makes an offer of proof at page 183 and 184 of the record and talks about how what the video would have shown. So it's clear that at some point, Mr. Curtis told counsel what it would have shown. What the detail that he went into in the initial letter that he sent to counsel or in that initial phone call is not in the record, but we know at some point that counsel was made aware of it because counsel eventually asked the state for it and then eventually asked the court to make an adverse inference because of the destruction of the evidence.
Well, you've made a point though about the delay, and we don't know, he said, we don't know what he said to counsel and saying, hey, there's this video, you really ought to take a look at it. I'm not saying that excuses counsel, but if he had provided more detail and we knew that, it would be easier to determine any issues about any future issues about ineffective assistance of counsel or present issues.
I mean, we know that the defendant, at least at a, you know, at least some cursory level, told counsel that the nature of what was going to be in there. We don't know if it was exactly word for word or not, but we also know that the counsel who represented Mr. Curtis in these proceedings was the same attorney who had represented him at the plea stage and who was well aware that there was a long history between the accuser and Mr. Curtis of the accuser coming to jail and making statements that, you know, about why she had made the allegations. So counsel was on notice that this could be something of some import. And, you know, counsel was also aware that this was just, you know, a accuser's word versus defendant's word sort of case. So any sort of impeaching information would be critical to the defense. And there's—
Excuse me. If we look at what the defendant's testimony was under oath, that is really different than what he initially described was on this recording. Under oath, he did not testify that Guerrero said that she lied to the police in relating what happened on October 7th and those events. Isn't that correct? I mean,
he didn't use those specific words. He said, when he was asked, did she say anything to you about why she made the allegations? He gave that reason, but he was never specifically asked the question, did she tell you that she lied to the police? Unfortunately, the way that the questioning happened at the hearing, no, he did not specifically testify to that.
Right. He had the opportunity. So how would this recording have led to a different outcome in this case? How would that recording, if it had been used, led to a different outcome?
Well, I believe that the, you know, the reason that the judge made the finding that the judge ultimately did, this, the judge said that he found Mr. Curtis's version of events to be simply not credible. And had this tape been admitted into evidence, then that necessarily would have affected the circuit court judge's, you know, evaluation of the credibility of the evidence, because it would have shown that the accuser had misled the court during her testimony. And it also would have provided some corroboration, since, you know, Mr. Curtis's whole version of events was that the accuser had made up these allegations and, you know, had attacked him because she was upset that this bra was found in his bag and she, you know, believed that he was cheating on her. Her own words that she believed she was cheating on her would have corroborated his version of the of events.
However, the trial court would have known that she had a prior criminal record and have heard about impeachable offenses, correct?
Yeah, the trial court was aware of her history.
And would have been able to take that into account in evaluating her testimony, or this recording.
Yes, that would have existed. But I mean, that sort of evidence, you know, the fact that she's a methamphetamine addict, her criminal history, those sorts of things, you know, do impeach her testimony and you know, kind of establish how weak the state's case was here that Mr. Curtis had violated his probation. The only evidence that existed was her testimony. And if the factual basis of that testimony is impeached by her own statements, at some point, that's not enough to take away Mr. Curtis's freedom.
What about the recorded phone calls?
There were recorded phone calls in this case.
Were those about the October incident?
There was some dispute over that. There were phone calls in which Mr. Curtis made some statements, you know, about, you know, in which he apologized, in which he, you know, talked about, you know, having done something, but he talked about it in a very vague manner. So it could be interpreted.
I agree that it's not specific the way that you'd like a witness or anybody to say, but when he says essentially that he fucked up and he did that shit, that sounds pretty damning.
I mean, it could very well be an admission that he struck the victim. Absolutely, it could be that. But it could also, I mean, if he's a man who's in a relationship with a woman and he cheated on her, it could also very much be an admission that he had done that shit and that he had effed up in that way.
Well, what about him telling her to say that she was upset and called the police because she caught him kissing another man? That sounds like he's trying to manufacture some reason for her to explain to the police why she called as she did.
And that's a good point, Your Honor. I mean, both sides in this case, neither side is a perfect witness. They both have credibility issues. But we have to look at the history of what happened in this case to really understand the context of his trying to get her to make that allegation that he'd kissed another man. And he provided an explanation for that in his testimony when he told the court that in the underlying case, the strangulation case that Justice Connect brought up before, that the accuser had gone to the prosecutor's office at that time and told them that she had falsified the original allegations, and the prosecutor's office did not believe her, would not believe her recantations. So he tried to, since he knew that her recanting the allegations for in his view, the truthful reason, you know, going in and telling them the story about how he had cheated on her, would not change the prosecutor's mind. So yes, he did something wrong. He told her to make up this lie. And that does go to his credibility. It is a problem.
Counsel, excuse me. Before your time is up, I'd like to talk to you for a minute about your argument and view of Taylor and Youngblood. And it's my understanding that it's your position that the United States Supreme Court case, Arizona versus Youngblood, did not overrule the part of Taylor that talks about the right of confrontation. Is that correct?
In a very narrow sense, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But in taking that position, aren't you overlooking the fact that the right of due process encompasses the right of confrontation?
No. And here's why, Your Honor. There are two different rights of confrontation. There is, particularly in the probation violation or general violation context, there's the constitutional right, you know, which comes from the Sixth Amendment, but then comes down to us through the 14th Amendment. That's part of due process. And if the Illinois legislature had never passed a statute on any of this, yes, there would be a very limited due process right to confrontation. And the state's argument in this case would be right. We'd be out of luck due to Youngblood and all the cases that the state cites. But in the probation violation, conditional discharge violation context, there is also a statutory right to confrontation. And that is an absolute right to confrontation. So, in the reply brief, when I cited, the cases that talk about that, such as Williams and Everhart and Davis versus Alaska, that talk about how confrontation includes cross-examination, if under the Illinois statute there is this absolute right to confrontation, then that includes an absolute right to cross-examination and confrontation with impeachment evidence. So that's how it applies here, is that absolute confrontation right is different from the due process right that the state talks about in its briefs.
So are you saying that a defendant in a revocation proceeding is statutorily entitled to more protection than a defendant in a criminal trial would be?
I wouldn't say more, I would say different, coming from a different source. So if this were a criminal trial, Mr. Curtis would have been entitled to these protections in a different way. The state would have been required to provide these things under the regular rules of discovery. So ultimately it would end in the same result. But here, yes, in this very narrow context, the right to confrontation that the Illinois legislature has provided is absolute. That's what the court held in Lindsay. And so in this very narrow context, that's how the procedural safeguard that the Illinois legislature has determined applies in this case.
Well, counsel, the case you're saying about the absolute right, I think you're misreading that. The Supreme Court simply was saying that unlike the federal law, there are conditions sometimes in federal law where the probationer does not have the right to counsel. And there are certain conditions where the absolute right to confront does not exist. There's a condition on that. I think that's all they meant. I don't think they meant that there is a confrontation right that exceeds what is afforded in the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Is that what you're saying? That confrontation right in a criminal trial is different than the confrontation that the General Assembly provided for in the statute?
No,
that seems a little far-fetched.
No, that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. I'm sorry if that's the impression that I gave. What I'm saying is that the constitutional right to confrontation in a probation violation proceeding is a lesser right. And that right would apply no matter what state we were in. There's a constitutional right that is a limited conditional constitutional right to confrontation in a probation violation proceeding. But in Illinois, we also have a statutory right to confrontation in these proceedings. And that right is greater than just the constitutional due process right to confrontation. But if this were a jury trial, then yes, obviously there's a greater due process right in a jury trial to confrontation than there is in one of these violation proceedings. So really we're talking about three different rights.
But then where was there not a right to confrontation here? I mean, there was a right, she testified, there was cross-examination. I mean, what was...
He was deprived of his right to meaningful cross-examination in that part of his right to confrontation and cross-examination is his right to impeach. And because a state actor destroyed the piece of evidence that he would have impeached her with, he was not able to confront her.
Well, you concede that there was no bad faith, however, here. Isn't that correct on the part of the state?
Yes, but bad faith is a due process question. And the statutory right has nothing to do with due process.
Well, that goes back to the question I asked at the beginning. And you're saying, what is your authority for that? That the statutory right has nothing to do with due process?
I see I'm out of time. Can I answer Your Honor's question?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Justice Connacht.
That comes back to People versus Lindsay, that recognized that there are two different rights. There is the constitutional due process right to confrontation in these hearings, and that is a limited and a conditional right that is limited only to the bare minimum requirements of due process. And the legislature has passed the statutory right, which provides greater protections.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal. Mr. Malcolm, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. This case presents two issues. First, whether the state's failure to preserve a video recording of a visit between Breonna Guerrero and defendant while defendant was incarcerated violated defendant's confrontation rights, and whether hearing counsel was ineffective for not obtaining a copy of that video recording prior to the hearing. For the following reason.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm bothered by, or I would like to know your response to the question I asked opposing counsel with regard to the right of confrontation and due process. She articulated that there was a different right of confrontation because it was statutory that was absolute, whereas the due process right to confrontation was not. What is your position with regard to that?
The context of a conditional discharge revocation hearing shows that the defendant is entitled to the minimum requirements of due process. And Illinois case law has cited four particular elements that constitute those minimum requirements. The third of those is the opportunity to present evidence and confront witnesses. That's from People v. Steele, a First District case from 1996. Thus, in the context of a conditional discharge revocation hearing where the defendant is entitled to the minimum requirements of due process, that encompasses the defendant's confrontation right. Therefore, I believe that your questions were well taken and well made, that and it's the state's position that regardless of whether we're looking from the federal or the state side of things, the due process umbrella encompasses the confrontation rights, at least in this context of a conditional discharge revocation hearing.
If this had been perfected, well, let me ask another way. Would you concede that counsel had a right to see that video on behalf of his client?
No, Your Honor. The Illinois Supreme Court has found that prior to a conditional discharge revocation hearing, a defendant is not entitled to discovery, and that discovery is not required in order to protect a defendant's confrontation rights. That is People v. DeWitt, 1979 Illinois State Supreme Court case, which my brief cites. And thus, the defendant was not entitled to discovery. Thus, defendant was not entitled to obtain a copy of the video recording.
Well, if he made a specific request for it and the offer of proof showed or indicated it would be impeaching of the victim's testimony or position, would a court have the power to grant it?
The court certainly has the power to grant it. Just because a defendant is not entitled to discovery at such a hearing does not mean that discovery cannot be granted.
So do you concede that, or would you be willing to concede, which I don't like to ask counsel to do that had this specific request been made and the trial court said, oh, I understand exactly what you're asking for, and I understand how this could be impeaching if it were granted, and the video existed, and it showed what defendant purported it would show, could the outcome of this case been different?
Assuming all of the things that you're...
Yeah, I know those are assumptions.
It is the state's stance that defendant would have then needed to make a bad faith showing, as is the state's position that the evidence in question was not materially exculpatory, but rather potentially useful.
Well, absent bad faith, would he still be entitled to at least view it and decide whether he could get that admitted at the revocation or violation hearing? What I'm really getting at is what we're talking about is not the sheriff and not the state's attorney. We're actually talking about the defendant's counsel. That counsel should have acted quicker. Counsel asks, the sheriff says, okay, we'll preserve it. And then he goes through the process of trying to obtain it. Maybe he gets it, maybe he doesn't. But there's at least a strong possibility that a trial court informed of it would give it to him. I'm not trying to set up a case for ineffective assistance of counsel. I'm just trying to understand where we are.
I apologize. I'm not entirely sure I'm following your honor or understanding what exactly you're asking me directly.
Well, that's probably my fault. Not yours. I will tell you out loud, I don't know if that it will affect the result, that it seems to me counsel was negligent. Now, whether it would have made a difference, we don't know, because the evidence isn't presented before us. It would still be a matter of weighing the evidence, which the trial court would be permitted to do. But I don't think there's anybody that would say this was a sterling performance by counsel if he was alerted to the fact that such a video existed.
I would say that that's a fair assumption or a fair assessment.
If you were the attorney for the defendant, would you have asked for that video once your counsel told you it existed? Of course you would have. That's not really a concession. That's an opinion. But I'll leave you alone with that, because I see by your smile that you probably would have answered yes. You may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, I guess I'm going to jump in with another question. I mean, didn't the absence of this video interfere with the defendant's ability to cross-examine, or as opposing counsel said, to impeach Guerrero?
No, Your Honor, because...
And why not?
Because the defendant also had attempted to impeach Guerrero with a letter that Guerrero allegedly wrote to defendant while defendant was incarcerated, which contained the same or similar statements that were allegedly contained on the video. And the state would contend that the defense mischaracterizes those statements. In fact, defendant during the hearing testified that Guerrero merely apologized to him for telling law enforcement that he struck her and kicked in her door. Apologizing for something does not mean that you did not do something. In fact, this testimony is consistent with the conclusion that Guerrero reported truthfully regarding what occurred, and then due to her strong feelings for defendant, felt remorse or sympathy or empathy that defendant was subsequently incarcerated for his actions. And as a result, the state urges that this court to find that this evidence was not exculpatory, but potentially useful, thus requiring the bad faith showing, which has not been made.
And are you then therefore arguing, counsel, that based upon the defendant's testimony, we can't find that it was exculpatory or inculpatory. We can't find either way, just that it was potentially useful, correct? Am I following your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And with regard to the discovery, as you have indicated, according to case law, doesn't apply to revocation of conditional discharge proceedings, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet the motion that was filed by defense counsel for a, quote, negative inference, end quote, alleged a discovery violation, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, that's incongruent in the fact that you allege that there's a, the defendant alleges there's a discovery violation, but the defendant's not even entitled to discovery. So how does that tie into this, these issues before the court? Because I know you mentioned that in your brief.
Certainly, as I said to Justice Kinect earlier, a defendant is not entitled to discovery. That does not mean that a trial court cannot grant a discovery request. And so the defendant is certainly, and defense counsel is certainly entitled to request to make this filing. However, the trial court has the discretion to then deny or reject that. Further,
didn't the trial court say that had defense counsel requested a subpoena for the tape or an order for the recording tape to be preserved, that that would have been an avenue to make sure that it was available?
Yes, the trial court did.
Okay.
And
what happened to case 2020 CF 672? I think that's the right number. That's the allegations in the petition to revoke the conditional discharge contained a criminal offense, which, as I understand it, was charged in 2020 CF 672. Am I right?
Off the top of my head, I cannot answer that information with in an informed manner. I can look into that and type up a memo if you would so desire.
I don't think I desire that, but what I'm getting at is, as you well know, when a petition to revoke probation or conditional discharge in this case is filed based upon a criminal offense, there is that underlying criminal offense should the state choose to proceed on that. And there's also then the petition to revoke, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, if I'm understanding the defendant's argument, if the state had prosecuted on the underlying criminal offense, and that is 2020 CF 672, because it was charged apparently, then in that case, defense counsel would have had to have shown that the video was something more than potentially useful, would have had to show that it tended to exonerate. Otherwise, the ruling would be that there's no confrontation violation. But because the criminal case wasn't prosecuted and we're proceeding under the petition to revoke conditional discharge, that the statute allows this negative inference, I guess, because the potentially useful versus exoneration is no longer applicable in a revocation proceeding, only in the criminal charge itself. Am I misstating anything there, or is that your understanding of the defendant's argument? If it isn't, go ahead and say so.
At this stage, I do not feel confident saying one way or the other the veracity of what you said. I apologize. I did my best to follow, but at this point in time, my research did not encompass that particularly.
Okay. If I misstated something, it wasn't because of the lack of veracity. I just misunderstood something, just to clarify. Anyway, go ahead.
Um, where the state is not obligated to preserve evidence, no error occurs where the evidence is subsequently destroyed pursuant to standard operating procedures. As previously stated, the state was not obligated to preserve this video recording because the defendant was not entitled to discovery prior to this hearing. And the Illinois Supreme Court has found that a defendant's statutory right to confrontation is not violated during conditional discharge hearing due to a lack of discovery. Therefore, because the state was not obligated to preserve this evidence, the subsequent failure to preserve the evidence did not violate defendant's confrontation clause right. Justice Zinoff did a very good job of covering my point about due process encompassing the confrontation right. Because those rights are joined, one falls under the other, defendant's effort to bifurcate the Pieper v. Taylor holdings is unavailing in the instant case. Even if this court finds that Pieper v. Taylor's confrontation rights holding remains good law in this state for the purposes of conditional discharge revocation hearings, the two rights, one nests under the other, and they cannot be distinguished, such that that reasoning does not win the day here. Further, even if this court finds that the confrontation rights holding of Taylor remains good law, People v. Taylor is distinguishable from this case. In Taylor, the evidence in question was consumed prior to the indictment, such that when the defendant was ultimately charged, defendant could not independently test that evidence, such that defendant was at a substantial evidentiary disadvantage. Here, following the destruction of the video recording, both the state and defendant were able to present the testimony of participants of that conversation. Defendant testified to his recollection of the visit. Guerrero testified to her recollection of the visit. And both parties stipulated to what the corrections officer who oversaw the visit would have testified to had the corrections officer appeared in the hearing. Thus, no substantial evidentiary disadvantage was created, and therefore this case is distinguishable from People v. Taylor. For these reasons, this court should affirm the trial court's judgment. And unless this court has questions regarding the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, the state will rest on its brief.
I see no questions. Are there any?
I have no further questions at this time.
The state will have the remainder of its time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mason, rebuttal.
Get myself unmuted. May it please the court. I would like to briefly address a concern that Justice Zinoff brought up earlier in today's discussion, and that has to do with the fact that Mr. Curtis did not testify specifically at the hearing that his accuser had explicitly told him that she lied to police, and that is a true fact. However, I would direct the court specifically to page 291 of the transcript, where Mr. Curtis was being asked about that matter. And at first, his counsel asked him, "What did she say?" And he starts to explain, "She was drilling me on the fact, who was the girl? Why did I bring that girl into the house? And she was asking me why I was cheating on her. Was that my baby she was pregnant with?" And then counsel asks him specifically, "Did she talk to you about October 7th at all?" He responds that she did. Counsel asks, "What did she say?" And Mr. Curtis started to answer. He said, "She was like she was sorry for telling the police that I hit her. And she was sorry for everything that happened, telling the police that I kicked in the door and then counsel cut him off and didn't allow him to finish his answer to that question, instead specifically directing him to answer whether she made any statements about why she had said those things to police. And which then Mr. Curtis, told counsel in the court why she had made those statements, what she had told him about why she made those statements. So his opportunity to give a full detailed recitation of exactly what she told him during that meeting was cut off by his counsel. That same counsel made an offer of proof to the court prior to the hearing beginning at page 183 through 184 of the record. And at that time, counsel detailed exactly what it was that he believed occurred during that conversation. And that included the allegations that she admitted that she had fabricated the allegations to police. Counsel never gave Mr. Curtis the opportunity to put that into his testimony. That's why it's not there, but we do have
Is that a new claim of ineffective assistance that you're making on appeal now?
No.
That you haven't made before?
No. I just
want to- It sounds like you're saying it was ineffective cross or direct examination. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it may well be, but no, I'm not raising that new argument now. I just want to give that-
Well, then it's a problem. I think it's a problem because you just, and I've got it in front of me as well. You just read what the testimony was, and defendant never said that she had lied before in what she had told the police. She just explained why she told, because she was mad about he was cheating on her. But that doesn't mean that, or doesn't suggest that, it didn't happen. He could have testified to that. And I'm reading through here. I don't see where defense counsel kept him from saying that. He just didn't say it. I think it's a problem.
Well, defense counsel did cut him off, though. We have the indication from the court reporter where he says, and there's the dash. And then we have the question from counsel. So the court reporter did not take that as a period, a finished sentence here. Moving on to the next question, there was an interruption there, and counsel never went back and gave him that opportunity. That being said, the reason I bring this up...
I think that the reason counsel probably cut him off because he wasn't saying what counsel wanted him to say, because he was saying, here's what he said, she was sorry for telling the police that I hit her, and she was sorry for everything that happened, telling the police that I kicked in the door, and... Looks like to me, counsel's thinking, well, I'm not getting the response I want. So he moved on with the question, did she make any statements about why she said those things to the police? That was his opportunity to say what you say the video would have showed, but he didn't. He didn't testify to that. It's just not there.
Well, he did testify as to why she said the reason that she gave him for telling the police that. And that... By giving that testimony, it's saying that's the reason why she said this, not because it happened, but because she believed that he'd been cheating on her. But we also have the offer of proof from counsel. An officer of the court told the court prior to the beginning of the hearing that this is what the video would have shown.
Well, and then counsel... He told the court that's what defendant told me, because he didn't see the video, obviously, because it got destroyed, right? Well, there's a difference there, isn't there?
There's a difference there, and I see I'm out of time. Can I briefly respond?
You may answer.
And that's the problem. Counsel dropped the ball, and because counsel dropped the ball, nobody has the video, and nobody can answer these questions. If counsel had gotten the video and then just not presented it, we could go get the video, look at the video, and see, was counsel ineffective for not presenting this, yes or no? But because counsel dropped the ball even more and didn't even bother to go get it, now we can't do that. Now we can't prove that to the court. And that's not Mr. Curtis's fault. It's counsel's fault. And that was ineffective.
I want to ask one more question. I want you to answer it briefly. What do we make of the fact that the victim disputes the fact that she ever wrote these letters? I.e., if the trial court believes her, that really undermines all the credibility that the defendant could possibly have creating those letters. Now, the trial court could say, well, I don't know what, you know, she's going by, it's not my handwriting. The trial court doesn't have to believe that. But if the trial court did, it would be assessing credibility. Wouldn't that weigh heavily against your client?
Well, the accuser admitted that she had sent the photographs, but denied sending the letters. And yes, if the judge believed her, then that, you know, would absolutely be, you know, go against the defendant's credibility. But we have evidence that the accuser lied to the court. The only disinterested party in this whole case was the corrections officer who testified by stipulation that was entered by the parties. And the accuser testified under oath that she and Mr. Curtis did not break up during the conversation. And the one and only thing that the jail guard remembered from the conversation was that they definitely broke up. The corrections officer has no reason to lie about that. If anything, the nature of the corrections officer's employment would make them a traditionally more pro-state witness. But the accuser was lying. For that reason and all the other reasons we've discussed, I ask that this court reverse the judgment of the court below.
Thank you. I thank both counsel for your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement.